Thank you very much. Well, I wanted to begin this new topic and this section, no surprise, with a story. And I want to tell you the story of these two young men, Dan James, so on your left, and Matt Hampson on your right. And Dan and Matt, while they didn't know each other and don't know each other, didn't grow up together, do have a number of similarities in their lives. The first is that they're both from England, which means they have fantastic accents. The second thing is, being from England, they grew up playing rugby. They both were very good at rugby. And incidentally, when both of them, again, independent of each other, not growing up together, when both of them were in their early 20s, playing rugby in a scrumming practice, both of them became victims of accidents where they both got hurt so badly that they became paralyzed. Dan, again on your left, became paralyzed from the chest down. Matt became paralyzed from the neck down and requires a ventilator. Those are what's similar about these men. But here's an important difference. Dan is dead, and Matt is still alive. Dan opted for assisted suicide. He was flown to Switzerland and was killed at a euthanasia clinic there. Matt, on the other hand, runs a charity. He raises money for spinal care. He coaches children at physio sessions. He's a columnist who loves to write and is a motivational speaker. When I learned the stories of Dan and Matt and their similar experiences, but their very different responses, I was reminded of the writings of one of my favorite authors, who is also a psychiatrist and a Holocaust survivor. And his name is Dr. Viktor Frankl. And he has written a book I highly recommend called Man's Search for Meaning. In that book, Dr. Frankl makes the following observation. The last of the human freedoms that can never be taken from us is the freedom to choose how to respond to the situation that we're in. Just because we experience suffering, as both men did, it doesn't mean we have to choose despair, which Dan opted for. It's possible that we can find meaning in our circumstances, which Matt found. And in explaining his philosophy, Dr. Frankl has come up with a simple mathematical equation. It goes like this. D equals S minus M. What does that mean? Despair is suffering without meaning. If you can't eliminate suffering, but you want to make sure you don't despair, then you have to increase your meaning. You have to find meaning. And when you do that, that is proof that we are not forced to go only one way, a life of misery, despair that will end in suicide. There is another way. There is a better way. Dr. Frankl gives an example from his own work. A woman, in this case, who was paralyzed, she was a quadriplegic. She was a young student when this happened. And he said, she wrote me, and she spends her days reading the news and watching the news. And then when she comes across a story of someone who has suffered in some way, someone who's going through a difficult time, she asks someone to approach her and put a little stick in her mouth so she can use that stick to type out keys on a keyboard to write letters to those individuals to give them a message of hope and encouragement. And Dr. Frankl said, that young woman lives a very full life. The last of the human freedoms that can never be taken from us is the freedom to choose how to respond to the situation we're in. This next presentation is about equipping us with messages that we can communicate to others to show them there's a different way than what our world says. Assisted suicide and euthanasia do not have to be chosen. And so there's three things that I want to do in this presentation. The first thing is I want to carry on with what I just did a moment ago with telling you a few more stories that I believe reveal core principles that should guide our thinking on this topic. Then what we're going to do is examine the reasons people want assisted suicide and what our responses can be that show another way, a better way. And we're going to end with the third point, very practically, what do we do? Where do we go from here with the reality of what's happening in the information that we now have? So this first thing then, I want to tell you a few more stories like the one I just told you that identify core principles that should guide our thinking. So the next story I want to tell you is about, again, several young people. There was a young man who was in a room with a gun in his hand about to blow his brains off. And he had the TV on. And it just so happened that the TV channel that was on had an interview happening. And the interview involved a young Colombian woman by the name of Zuli. And she was telling her story. And this young man, gun in hand, looked at the TV and listened to Zuli's story. Zuli was born, like Nick, without arms and legs. At the age of 2, her dad committed suicide. At the age of 7, she was raped. Throughout her childhood, she was bullied. And at the age of 15, she contemplated suicide. But Zuli is now a motivational speaker and one incredible artist. She lives a full and rich life, and that's why she was being interviewed on TV. And this suicidal man about to blow his brains out watched her story, put down his gun, wrote her a letter, and became her friend. Contrast that story with the story of Will. Will was a client of a man who's a criminal defense attorney, David Dow. You can watch his TED Talk online. And David tells Will's story. When Will was a preborn child, his father abandoned his mother. Then when Will was 5, his mother, who was afflicted with paranoid schizophrenia, tried to kill Will with a butcher knife. Will was then sent to live with his brother, who he lived with until his brother committed suicide. By the age of 9, Will was living on his own. He eventually joined a gang, committed a murder, and Will isn't alive today because he was killed by death penalty. What's the point of these stories? What lesson do I think they communicate? This. The words of the great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King said, "We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied to a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." That young man in the room with the gun was impacted by Zuli's choice not to kill herself. And had she directly acted on only herself, it would have had an effect on others. Her absence from the world would have meant that boy would have never seen her story and may have followed through on his suicide. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. The choices of Will's father, mother, brother, and all the other people around him impacted him. Here's how this is relevant. In the euthanasia debate, assisted suicide debate, people say, look, it's just my life, has no impact on you. We are all impacted by the legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia. First of all, some of us are not going to be able to trust our doctors anymore. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Can I be sure they have my well-being in mind? Are they going to protect my life? Maybe I won't tell them everything I'm experiencing because I'm afraid of what they might do. And breaking down the trust between the patient and the healthcare provider is a very dangerous thing. There are others who will ask for euthanasia, but not because they really want it, but because the climate of a culture which has legalized it has made them feel like their life is a waste and burdensome, and they're almost guilted into asking for it. They won't admit that. They won't tell us that. But some will be guilted in. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. There will be missed opportunities, as there could have been a missed opportunity if Zuli had killed herself, if someone follows through with assisted suicide and euthanasia, things that they could have done, relationships that they could have mended or had, or whatever the case may be, will not happen if assisted suicide and euthanasia proceed. So whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. The next story I wanted to tell you that reveals an important principle is a story involving this young woman. Her name is Jewel Shuping. Jewel is blind, but she's not blind because she had some pathology in her body that took away her sight. She's blind because from a young age, she desperately wanted to be blind. Jewel has a condition called Body Integrity Identity Disorder, BIID for short. And this is a condition where people who are physically healthy desperately desire to be maimed in some way. Often it presents itself as people who have healthy limbs going to their doctors and asking their doctor to amputate a healthy arm or amputate a healthy leg. In Jewel's case, she felt from the time that she was a young child that she was supposed to be blind. And so she says that she had convinced her psychologist to put droplets of drain cleaner in her eyes. And by the time she was in her 20s, she was blind. Now, why do I tell you this story? How does it relate to euthanasia? Because it reveals this important principle. Sometimes we humans have disordered desires. And sometimes we ask for things that the people around us who love us actually shouldn't follow through on. And the same can be said when someone asks for assistance with death. Which leads me to the next story, which reveals an important principle. The story really probably only requires stating a word and we'll all understand. Attawapiskat. It's almost a year ago, spring of 2016, that a state of emergency was declared in that First Nations community in Northern Ontario. Why? Because of such an alarming rate of suicide amongst teenagers. In March of last year, in April of last year, there were 11 attempts of suicide. And in March of last year, there were 28 attempts of suicide amongst these teenagers. What was our government's reaction? Send help to try to get to the root of the problem so these teenagers don't kill themselves. So the Health Canada sent up 18 additional people, crisis coordinator, youth support workers, psychologists. So here's the principle. Rather than aiding the suicides, the response was to identify what was motivating the desire and trying to fix that. That's what we can apply in the euthanasia debate. What's motivating people? And then fix the underlying problem rather than follow through on the request. The last point for this first section that I want to address is a story that God gives us in his word, Matthew 25, where we're told the Son of Man is going to come in all his glory, angels around him. He'll be on his throne. He's going to start separating the nations as though a shepherd is separating sheep from goats. And we're told the sheep will be on his right and say, "Come, O blessed," and he will say, "Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food, thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me, naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. As you did it to one of the least of these brethren, you did it to me. I was sick and you visited me." It was not, "I was sick and you took me out of my misery." It was not, "I was sick and you killed me." The principle we can extract from these words is the importance of visiting and comforting the sick. Last June, our government enacted legislation that allows for assisted suicide and euthanasia. And between the middle of June of last year, when that legislation was enacted, and the middle of December, already in our country, 744 people have been assisted with their suicides. They've been killed. Between mid-June and mid-December, that means four every day. We want to help people realize that instead of choosing assisted suicide and euthanasia, we should visit the sick. We should get to the root of the problem. We should not follow through on someone's desire that is fundamentally disordered. We should realize we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied to a single garment of destiny, and that what affects one directly will affect all indirectly. And we should help people see, as Dan and Matt's story show, the last of the human freedoms that can never be taken from us is the freedom to choose how to respond to the situation we're in. And tonight, in this presentation, it's about helping us help others to see they can choose another way and a better way than assisted suicide and euthanasia. So that leads me then to the second part of my presentation, where I want us to consider what are the reasons people have for supporting, wanting assisted suicide and euthanasia, and what ought our responses be? What should they be? Of all the reasons, there's five in particular that I think are the main ones that I want to highlight this evening. The first is physical pain. And we want to find common ground and agree that that's a problem. Where we're disagreeing with euthanasia supporters is on the solution to that problem. Instead of killing the person, we want to kill the pain. We want proper pain management. And the good news is, a majority of pain can be managed thanks to modern medicine. In fact, conventional medications, so we're talking like morphine and other narcotics, are able to control up to 97% of pain. Now, I know some people will immediately respond with, but what about the other 3%? And we'll address that in a moment, but I think this point is worth emphasizing because the vast majority of physical pain someone could be in, we actually have medication to address. I actually recently texted a friend of mine who's a pediatric surgeon, and I said, she does surgeries both in Canada as well as overseas in Africa. So I said, in your experience in the Western world where we have good pain medication, have you ever seen a case where one of your patient's pain could not be adequately managed? And her response, no, I have never seen that. We're always able to manage my patient's pain. She goes, sometimes the amount needed is to help the patient does require making them unconscious, but we nonetheless have been able to manage their pain. I realize some people will say, but what about pain we can't manage? And that is a problem. And the slogan that I often live by to respond to that problem is this: shouldn't we alleviate suffering without eliminating the sufferer? Shouldn't we alleviate suffering without eliminating the sufferer? What does that look like? I'm going to play for you a video of a young boy who lives with excruciating pain, because I want to be intellectually honest and talk about the reality that some people live with horrible pain, and I don't want to minimize that or pretend that doesn't happen in some cases. But there's an important lesson to be learned from this young boy's experience of life with pain. I'll let the story reveal that, but to put some context to it, the condition this young boy has is called epidermolysis bullosa, or EB for short. It's a horrible skin condition where severe and painful blisters form all over the body. Friction or touch to the skin can result in more blisters. These blisters can also develop internally down the throat so that even the swallowing of food can cause excruciating pain for people with this condition. So let's take a look at the story of Jonathan Petra, who lives with EB.
To help manage his condition and prevent infection, Jonathan and Tina must go through the most excruciating process of Jonathan's day, his bath.
One, two, three, up.
Once he's fully soaked, the two carefully remove all the bandages from Jonathan's body. It's an incredibly delicate process.
It's always that battle between pain and not. What?
Nothing, I just want you to keep taking your dressing off. Is there more skin on your hand? Yeah. I saw it, Johnny. You didn't have to show me. I know. I saw that too.
So then, it really hurts for her. Obviously.
The bath is just the first part of the process. The second part involves putting a new set of dressings on his body. In total, the bath and dressing can take over 3 hours, and Jonathan and Tina must do it every other day.
Probably the biggest challenge, being so helpless in front of your kid and having to do dressings and, I mean, you're the one who's hurting him. I've had Jonathan begging me to stop, and I can't.
This is not an easy process. It's one thing to hear about it, but it's another to see it. It's a lot different than what you think. You just see how, you know, we work as a team to do what has to be done, really.
Ta-da! We are Finny!
Woo!
Thank God.
There you go. I'm done.
Where do you get the strength to get up every morning knowing what you're going to have to go through?
That strength comes from the people around me, because they do believe in me that I can get through it.
For years, Jonathan believed he was the only one going through the pain. Until 2012, when he was invited to an EB conference in Toronto. It was a conference that changed his life.
I had never met anyone with my condition. I had never, you know, had any explanation. I had never known there was anyone else.
How did you feel when you saw the other kids that had it?
I knew that I wasn't alone anymore. I knew since then that I was going to become, you know, an ambassador. I wanted to start helping other people with EB.
In October of 2014, Jonathan put his story out to the world. With the help of the Ottawa Citizen, Jonathan courageously revealed his wounds to the masses. The article went viral throughout Ottawa and landed on a special team's doorstep.
I read it, and it was so moving that I brought the article in, and we talked about what we could do to help in any way we could.
November 20th, 2014. The Ottawa Senators invite Jonathan to a game and make him a scout for the day. He signs a pro contract from GM Brian Murray and takes questions from the media.
Is there any one particular area of the Senators you're going to be focusing in on tonight, or is it the whole team that you're going to watch?
A team isn't just made of one player, it's all of them, so I'll be watching the whole team.
The Ottawa Senators are proud to welcome their newest professional scout to the organization, Jonathan Witt. Jonathan, welcome to the organization.
Since his day with the Senators, Jonathan has helped raise over $100,000 for EB awareness. There is no cure for epidermolysis bullosa. Most butterfly children don't make it to the age of 30. It's a reality 14-year-old Jonathan deals with head on.
Have you thought a lot about the future?
Definitely. Evie's a cruel thing. And yes, I've thought about it for sure. Like, how can't you? He knows it's a reality. But I think I just pushed that aside. You know, I'm here, and I'm gonna go step by step, day by day, and you never know what the future holds. I may live to 100. We can't know. But I'm not gonna stop anytime soon. I'm gonna keep going.
Last week, when I spoke on this topic in North Vancouver, an audience member was there who has EB. When he was 2, he was told, his parents were told he wouldn't live really beyond that, or 3. He's 30. He told me he expects to live at least until 60. How is it possible for Mo and Jonathan to carry on when they're in such excruciating pain? It's possible when we look at this one piece of paper that if I try to rip, is really easy to rip by itself. But if I take a bunch of piece of papers and then I try to rip them, I can't, because they're together. And Mo and Jonathan have people around them. The theme of that documentary was team. And what's interesting is, even though Jonathan was suffering, what ultimately motivated him to become an ambassador for EB awareness and raise $100,000 was not his own personal suffering. It was becoming aware that there were others like him. And that spurred him on with hope. Despair is suffering without meaning. Jonathan's not despairing, and neither is Mo. Why? Because they have meaning. They look for meaning in their situation and what it motivates them to do. There's a local, amazing, wonderful pro-life physician here in Vancouver, Dr. Will Johnson. And when talking about euthanasia, has said, when you see only death as the solution, you throw creativity out of the window. Medical diligence goes out of the window. The need to actually solve the problem, the need to actually examine the patient to find a solution, goes out the window. Because if we kill all the people suffering in pain who have EB or another condition, what motivation do we have to come up with better pain meds? What motivation do we have to come up with cures if the people with the problem aren't around? We need to be motivated to make their situation better. And in the meantime, we can still alleviate their suffering as the presence of his mom and people who are supportive around him does. Which reminds me of our Lord's crucifixion. In John 19, verse 25, as Jesus is in excruciating pain hanging on the cross, having been abandoned by so many of his friends, has at the foot of his cross, standing there, his mother, her sister, Mary Magdalene, and John, who, like Jonathan's mother, is there, part of the team, letting them know they are not alone. And the presence of the other becomes a comfort. The next reason for assisted suicide and euthanasia, it's not so much physical pain as emotional pain. And I'd like to point out that, again, we can agree that that's a problem, but our response needs to be to get to the root of the problem, not assisted suicide. So we need counseling. We need to help find out what is creating the emotional anguish and then address that. And what asking that question can reveal is sometimes physical pain that people are in is a manifestation of an underlying emotional problem. And there's some physical pain we can't address because that's not ultimately the problem. Case in point, there's a palliative care physician here in Vancouver who shares a story of a patient of his named Alice. Alice was dying of lung cancer. She was in palliative care. And she had severe pain in her chest, which was not abnormal for someone in her situation. But what was abnormal was that this physician could not manage her pain. And he had many other patients like her who'd had the same type of lung cancer, and he could always manage their pain. But Alice's pain could not be lightened. She would scream out. She would writhe in pain. The other doctors and nurses would come out of the room and say to him, "Is there nothing you can do?" And so he went into Alice's room one day, and he got an inspiration to sit down next to her, gently put his hand on her arm, and he said, "Alice, I'm wondering if maybe I can't fix the pain in your chest, because Alice, I'm wondering if it's a pain I can't touch. I'm wondering if it's a pain in your heart." And this look of being understood washed over her. And she opened up and said, "Yes, I have one daughter, and she's dating a man I believe is very bad and will be no good for her. And because I'm dying and I don't have much time on this earth left, I told her what I thought, and she's disowned me." Her physical pain was a sign of an underlying emotional problem, and assisted suicide doesn't fix that. We want to repair broken relationships. There's a great country song by Tim McGraw that some of you may be familiar with, about a man who gets a terminal diagnosis. And he talks about going skydiving and Rocky Mountain climbing and doing 2.7 seconds on a bull named Fu Manchu. But the reason why I bring this song up is to give you the next line. He sings, "I loved deeper, I spoke sweeter, and I gave forgiveness I'd been denying." He sings, "I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying." Instead of assisted suicide, how can we try to repair fractured relationships? And the scriptures call us to this in Matthew 5:23. If you're offering your gift at the altar and you remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come offer your gift. While not an identical situation, I think from that statement, we can think about the importance of before coming face to face with our Creator, with whatever time we've been given left, how we ought to try to reconcile and give forgiveness we've been withholding, or receive forgiveness someone needs to give to us. A third and very common reason for assisted suicide and euthanasia is feeling like you're a burden. A lot of people feel, "Look, I'm a drain on the system. I'm a drain on my family. It's better that I be dead." And in this situation, we agree that's a problem, but the solution instead of assisted suicide is perspective. We want to help people see the same situation differently. We went through perspective in the last talk. I'll give you a lighthearted example. One of my favorite board games is called Telestrations, and I'm going to put one of the images on the screen that explains it. And so you're not overwhelmed, I'm going to use my little red pointer. So try to follow the pointer with me here. So the way this game works is you get a little whiteboard and a card, and there's something on the card like, you can see it here, it says doggy bag. So you write doggy bag down, and then you draw what you've written, and you flip and you pass it over. The next person has to guess what you've written, but they don't see the original writing. They guess what you've drawn. They don't see the original writing. They're just looking at your picture. So this person guessed doggy bag. Where's my little pointer? There we go. So then the next person draws what doggy bag is, and they pass it along, and that person thinks that's a purse snatcher. So then the next individual draws what they think a purse snatcher is, pass it on, and the next person guesses, well, that's a man purse. So it's like, ha, 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 it's kind of like telephone. Or here's another one. So wallflower, so this person draws a wall and a flower, pretty good. But this person perceives that as a man in the wall. So the next artist is pretty good. He draws a man in a wall, except the person looking at it thinks, oh, that's Han Solo. So when he passes on Han Solo, I mean, what a great artist here, eh? Not so great, because the person next to him thought that was a gangster. So then you get that drawing. So here's the point. You can look at the same thing and see it differently. And that's what we need to do when it comes to someone feeling like they're a burden. We want them to look at that situation differently. You're right, there is a burden here, we can say. But the burden is not you. The burden's the disease. And because I love you, I want to share the burden. I wish you didn't have to be burdened with it, but I will lighten the burden by sharing in it with you in some way. And so to give an example, I watched a documentary of a woman who felt like a burden and wanted assisted suicide. She was recently divorced, had one child, no husband to care for her, and her one daughter is finishing high school, about to go off to university. This woman felt like she was a burden on her daughter because her daughter had postponed her university education in order to care for her mom. And the woman wanted assisted suicide. And all I could think of as I was watching this documentary is that this daughter is going to learn more in the school of love than she ever would going to a post-secondary institution. And that reminds me of a beautiful quote in a very short book called On the Christian Meaning of Human Suffering. And the quote goes like this: suffering unleashes love. Suffering unleashes love. How true is that? When do we care for people? When do we help them out? Isn't it when they're vulnerable, weak, needy, and suffering in some way? So we want to help change people's perspective, and when they feel like they're a burden, we can say, your suffering will unleash my love, and I will delight in caring for you. Why? Because you're an image bearer. And maybe you can't do for me what you once did, but that doesn't matter, because you're an image bearer. And your value is in who you are, not what you do. Which leads to the next reason people give for assisted suicide and euthanasia. And that's that they feel useless. I watched two documentaries of two men who went overseas to Europe to get euthanasia at a clinic there. And their stories and personal lives were unfolded before this happened in front of the camera. And what came out was that one of these men had been a surgeon, and the other one had been a university professor. And as I watched their stories unfold, I thought, you know, the danger, the risk, when you've accomplished a lot by the world standards, is that you begin to put your identity in it. So that when you can no longer do the great things you once did, you wonder, what's the point of continuing to be? And so our response needs to be not assisted suicide, but helping people see their self-worth, that their value isn't in what they do. If the surgeon had never done surgery and the university professor had never taught a class, they would still be unrepeatable and irreplaceable because they're image bearers, individuals of great dignity. And so I want to play for you a clip that I believe reinforces the idea that our value is in who we are. Just before I play that clip, I want to put up for you one of my favorite billboards that I think is a great slogan for the clip you're about to see. It's a billboard from the Canadian Down Syndrome Society, and I love this message, celebrate being. Because ultimately we're human beings, not human doings. And we ought to celebrate that we are, not just, if at all, what we do. And so the video you're going to see takes two groups of human beings, the very old and the very young, who, by our world standards, not mine, but by our world standards, are kind of useless. And what this video shows is their dignity and the importance of celebrating being. So let's take a look.
What do you see? a brown bear.
A brown bear.
Mary McGovern is 95 years old, and one of her favorite things to do is to read to toddlers.
And what is that? A bird?
A bird.
A bird. What color is the bird?
Red.
Red. Everybody knows that.
Luckily for Mary, she doesn't need to go any further than down the hall to find her young friends.
Oh, see, look in here as a little kid. See that?
Oh, yeah.
McGovern lives at Providence Mount St. Vincent, a nursing home in Seattle, Washington, that also houses a daycare for children up to 5 years of age.
Can you hand out a scarf?
Thank you, honey. Thank you.
There you go.
Oh,
perfect.
Thank you.
Every weekday, 500 residents are joined by 125 children in the facility affectionately called the Mount.
Peekaboo.
Peekaboo.
I see you.
Administrator Charlene Boyd.
We wanted to create a place for people to come to live and not to come to die.
So in 1991, Boyd and other administrators added a high-quality preschool to the nursing home and created an intergenerational learning center, a community for the very old and very young.
Why is there this railing here?
This railing is here not for the kids, but it's here for residents. And it's a safety piece for a resident in a wheelchair to push themselves up and to hold on and to bring themselves to a standing position and watch the children through the window.
So they can stand here and look in.
They can stand here and look in.
It's putting high quality child care in a setting that links old and young together.
Say, have a nice day.
Making the magic between these two ages together, bringing joy to the residents and joy to those young children. It's just like this magical formula that happens every day. All of us have common needs to be recognized. All of us have common need to be loved, and all of us have common needs to share life together. And so these children bring life and vibrancy and normalcy. It's a gift. It's a gift in exposing young families to the positive aspects of aging, and it's a gift of also having children seeing frailty, normalcy, and that's part of that full circle of life.
He rocks in treetops all day long, hopping and bopping and singing his song.
Intergenerational activities can be spontaneous or planned, like this sing-along.
There's 36 visits possible each week. So each classroom, six classrooms, has at least three visits, up to six visits.
In my heart.
The director of the center, Marie Hoover, says children become comfortable with elderly residents at an early age.
Whether they're in a wheelchair or in a walker, or maybe they're hard to understand, or you have to speak louder, it is just about who that individual is and they adjust. The kids just don't, they really don't blink an eye. This is normal. This is just who this resident is.
93-year-old Harriet Thompson joined the sing-along on her way to the dining hall.
I usually like to go sit down for a while before dinner, but I heard them singing, so in we went.
What do you experience internally when you're around these children?
Happiness. Just plain old happiness. You know, yeah. It beats anything else. It beats television.
Boredom and loneliness are sort of the plagues of older adults.
There she goes. Yep.
There's nothing more delightful than seeing young children with noise, with laughter.
You see the residents and then hear the sound of the kids coming down the hall, and it's as though sunlight just came through the window.
The administrator of the Mount said, "We all have common needs to be recognized, to be loved, and to have someone to share life with." And that is what needed to be communicated to that surgeon and the professor. You don't need to do surgeries, although I understand you want to. You don't need to teach, although it makes sense you have the desire. But there are some things that you do need. You need to be recognized. You need to be loved. You need to have someone to share life with, and that we can do. So when someone feels that they're useless and people just want to say, therefore we need assisted suicide, therefore we need euthanasia, we want to go down and say, no, we We need to change their understanding of their self-worth. And the final reason that people typically give for why assisted suicide and euthanasia should be allowed is fear. Fear of a bad death. We want to acknowledge again that's a problem, but the solution isn't to create an unnatural death, but instead to introduce palliative care. To help an individual go through their last days or weeks or whatever the case may be as it naturally plays out. Palliative care is about helping the whole person. Certainly, they're very good with pain management and monitoring all the physical needs of a person. And there comes a time, too, where when death is near, that there might be some burdensome interventions that can be stopped because there's no hope of benefit and they are excessively burdensome. But palliative care, even if it withdraws some of these interventions, always provides care and treatment and the ordinary or proportionate interventions or treatments or care that a patient ought to have in the situation that they're in. And it treats the whole person, helping them find beauty, helping them be in relationship, helping stimulate their senses. Even if they're laying on a bed, that can be done. And to give you an example, there's a man by the name of Dr. B.J. Miller, who's a palliative care physician, but was once a patient himself. And when he was in university, long before he ever planned to go to med school, he was studying at Princeton and he was horsing around with friends one evening. And it was very late, in fact, very early. It was 3 a.m. one night. They were on campus. They saw this rail car on campus that was not running at that hour. And BJ said to his friends, "Hey, let's climb it." So they climbed to the top of the rail car and there were all these cables hanging down. And BJ put his arm up and he had a gold watch on. And the electricity arced out of the cables towards his watch, and 11,000 volts entered that arm and exited out his 2 feet. He spent months on a burn unit, and he shares a story about how there was this one night, there had been a massive snowstorm, and the nurses were coming into work late and grumbling about the weather and how it ruined their commute in. But he said, "There I was laying in the burn unit. He couldn't do anything, but he could think. And he started to think about the beauty of the snow. He had no window in his room, but he thought about the white fluff falling from the sky, creating a beautiful white blanket, glistening with the night lights. The next day, one of the nurses who came in smuggled in a snowball and put it on his burning skin. And he says, "I cannot tell you the rapture I felt holding that in my hand, the coldness dripping onto my burning skin, the miracle of it all, the fascination as I watched it melt and turn into water." Even in his suffering, immobile state, he could find beauty. His senses could be in some way stimulated, activated. And how can we get creative, he says, and do that for people in palliative care, people who are dying? So let's hear the words of Dr. Miller.
We need to lift our sights, to set our sights on well-being, so that life can become, and health care can become about making life more wonderful rather than just less horrible. Beneficence. Here, this gets right at the distinction between a disease-centered and a patient or human-centered model of care. And here is where caring becomes a creative, generative, even playful act. Play may sound like a funny word here, but it's also one of our highest forms of adaptation. Consider every major compulsory effort it takes to be human. The need for food is birth cuisine. The need for shelter has given rise to architecture. The need for cover, fashion. And for being subjected to the clock, well, we invented music. So, since dying is a necessary part of life, what might we create with this fact? By play, I am in no way suggesting that we take a light approach to dying or that we mandate any particular way of dying. There are mountains of sorrow that cannot move, and one way or another, we will all kneel there. Rather, I am asking we make space, physical, psychic room, to allow life to play itself all the way out. So that rather than just getting out of the way, aging and dying can become a process of crescendo through to the end. We can't solve for death. I know some of you are working on this. Meanwhile, we can design towards it. Now, parts of me died early on, and that's something we can all say one way or another. I got to redesign my life around this fact, and I tell you, it has been a liberation to realize you can always find a shock of beauty or meaning in what life you have left. Like that snowball lasting for a perfect moment, all the while melting away. If we love such moments ferociously, then maybe we can learn to live well, not in spite of death, but because of it. Let death be what takes us, not lack of imagination.
Let death be what takes us, not a lack of imagination. And that's ultimately why we ought to reject assisted suicide and euthanasia, because in those situations, death doesn't take us. We take death. Instead, we want to use our imagination. We want to get creative. We want to respect the dignity of the image bearer by being at the foot of the cross with them, or the foot of the bed. Being with. How can we get better at pain management? How can we restore fractured, broken relationships? How can we let music transform people's lives and bring them alive? I was talking to Austin about the power of a documentary I watched called Alive Inside. Highly recommend it. You can see it on Netflix. And it's so inspiring because it tells the story of old people with dementia who are sitting in old folks' homes, incapable of doing anything, sitting on a chair, zoned out, until a man came into their life who spends his days of retirement going around and interviewing their family to find out what music they listened to as children, as young adults. And then he creates a music playlist just for them and puts it on their ears. And people who forget everything start singing every single word. One woman who only ever walked with her walker when the music was on pushed it aside and began dancing because they were alive inside. So how do we prove people are alive inside? We celebrate being. We give them our attention. And so I want to conclude this presentation with the third part of my talk, which is the simplest of all. It's what do? I am on a mission right now to inspire every single one of my audience members when I speak on the topic of euthanasia to commit to going out once a week to visit the sick and the lonely. And I implore each one of you to do this in one of three ways. To think about your own family, or perhaps someone in your neighborhood who is alone, who you can intentionally visit each week. Hey, if you can do more, great. But I want something that I know every single one of us can at least do that. If not your family or your neighborhood, contact your pastor and ask if there are any shut-ins in your church who can't get out, who are lonely and need someone to visit them. The third option is to go to your local care home or nearby hospital and sign up for volunteering. And be very clear that the type of volunteering you want to do is to just go around and visit people. That's what I did for one of our local hospitals, and I'm now signed up to specifically go around once a week and just sit with people who are sick, maybe hold their hands. With some of them, we sing together. With others, I'll read Psalms. With others, they'll tell me their life story. But we celebrate being. And that's what I want to challenge each and every one of you to do. And I'd like to tell you two stories about that in conclusion. The first is from my friend Kathleen, who wrote the following. Every Friday morning, I've been spending an hour playing Scrabble with a lovely 93-year-old lady at a local care home. It's my simple way of helping the elderly find joy in their daily life. I'm always praying, she said, for opportunities to talk to her about God or simply show her that she is loved. Today, that opportunity came in full force. After our game, she outright asked me, "What do you think of doctor-assisted suicide?" and pointed to an article from the paper on the topic. I told her I felt it was very sad that anyone should feel the need to take their life, and it's our failure as a society when anyone is left feeling this way. After some time discussing this, she expressed to me that she can sympathize with people who don't feel they have a reason to live in their suffering, and that she too often wonders why God still has her stuck in a wheelchair. With tears in my eyes, I was able to tell her what a joy she is to me and that I look forward to visiting her every week. She teared up as well, shock in her eyes, and she said, "Really? Is that true?" And my friend nodded, unable to get more words out, the woman said to her, "Well then, perhaps there is reason enough for me to be here." Or there's my friend Kiana. She knew of a woman who wanted assisted suicide. She never broached that topic with her, but she did start to pay attention to her and visit her and spend more time with her and get to know her. And she found out several weeks later the woman was no longer interested in assisted suicide. Suffering unleashes love. And when we love people, we realize they're alive inside, and it will save their lives. Maybe literally in the case of an unplanned pregnancy, or figuratively in terms of their spirit and their will to live. And so that's what I challenge you to do. To take all you've learned and put it into practice by meeting the lonely and the sick and making their lives better by your love. Thank you very much.